Yeah, this allows me to kind of do these kind of things, right? Okay, back to where we were. I have this student, had the student. She was in the courses for the year and great. She was one that was just absorbing everything, and it was great fun. We got to the last of the courses for the year, and it was the last class of this one course, and we were talking about how do you gauge success? Now, how do you gauge success in ministry, but how do you gauge success in life? And we kind of put all these pieces together. We really emphasized the idea that it's not what we do that God is interested in. It's not, God is not impressed by our great efforts in doing stuff for Him. That the gauge of success is more in the realm of faithfulness, in the realm of allowing God to work through us in things. And sometimes it doesn't show up in big-time things happening. There's not great success in the world's eyes concerning how that plays out. And that it's not going to be those who accomplish massive things that God is going to say, well done. It's going to be those who have trusted Him in the midst of life as it plays out for them. And I thought this was going to be a great encouragement for this gal. Instead, I could see the blood draining out of her face. And I thought, gosh, did I say something wrong? I thought this was going to be good. And she hung afterward, and there were some other students with us, and we were kind of talking this out. And this whole idea of well done, she said, that implies that there'll be some that he doesn't say that to. And the idea of the talents, that there's a stern God. And this was kind of occupying her thoughts, so much so that, there were tears in the conversation. And I thought, wow, gosh, what's going on here? And it took some conversations, multiple conversations, before we kind of drilled down a bit. And she's Chinese. Just saying, okay, we're culturalizing things here. Turned out that her big concern was not really whether God was going to approve of her. But she came from a home that had, her grandmother was the matriarch of the family. It turns out that her grandmother was very disappointed that she had a granddaughter. And the student had spent her life somehow trying to gain the approval of her grandmother, to somehow accomplish great things so that her grandmother would say, yes, you're as good as a boy. And she realized it was a futile effort. And she somehow transferred that to how God would see her. Now, hang with that story. I'll complete it. I know I'm notorious for not finishing stories, but we will come back to that story. But to kind of just lay that out, because I think embedded in her story is perhaps all of our stories, this idea of desiring approval, longing to be right with those around us, for them to look at us and say, yes, that's it. Now, and take this into Psalm 37. As we've looked at this over the past couple of weeks, we've noted that David launches this psalm by putting in front of everyone a common issue that all Jewish people during that time and all the way down to Jesus' time maintained. And that was the idea that if I do what is right, if I take God at his word and I trust him and I do what is right, I pull this thing off, that God is going to be pleased with me. And how that's going to play out is in terms of God bringing into my life both peace and prosperity. He's going to deal with all my enemies and remove them, so I won't have enemies in my life. And he's going to make me successful and prosperous in whatever I do. In other words, my life is going to play out, and the proof that God is pleased with me is going to be no enemies and success in life. Now, whether you consciously think that or not, many believers hold that idea. That somehow God being pleased with me means that he will make things work out well in my life, that all these things will get ironed out and removed, and that somehow he will make me successful in life, and that's going to be my gauge of whether God is pleased with me. And David addresses this, saying that life at times, in fact, most of the time, feels like it's upside down. And he says, do not fret because of the evildoers, and do not be envious of the wrongdoers, those who somehow seem to be getting away with things, somehow violating the rules, and yet they come out on top of things. He says, don't let that drive you. Don't be concerned and wrapped up in all this stuff here. Not that we shouldn't be concerned about evil in the world and all, but it's this idea of don't let that be what drives your life. Instead, he drops in verse 2, the idea that there's a bigger story going on here. It says, for they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. That the story hasn't played out yet. It looks a certain way, but there's something else happening here. A larger story that is going on. In the midst of that, then, he gives four keys to life. Remember, this is written at the end of David's life. And so he's bringing this together and saying, I know it looks this way. I've experienced it. But he said, here are four keys to life. Four things that I've found to be absolutely true and need to be priorities in our life. They need to be what we build our life around. And he names them all. Boom, boom, boom. Four things. Trust in the Lord. Secondly, delight in the Lord. Third, commit your way to the Lord. And fourth, rest in the Lord. If you can just even memorize those as we go through these weeks, that those are easy cards to draw out again out of your mind and realize this is how life is to be built. We've gone through the first two of those already. First one he gives is in verse 3. He says, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Very first thing. Trust is the big piece. It's one thing to believe many things about God, but to turn those into relational value for us, they come in the form of trust. And I have to move what I believe about God into a relational, a relational term that moves those into something more than just intellectual knowledge. It's trust. And trust is that sense of well-being and security that results from placing confident expectations in God. It's the idea that our lives should be governed by who God is rather than how things appear. And as we do this, part of what we walked away with that week was the idea that trust frees us to live a non-reactive life. It frees us not to simply see ourselves as victims in this world, but to see life from a different perspective. He says, dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness, which faithfulness is the idea of active trust. It's this idea that as I settle into life as it is, that these become the setting in which I learn how to trust God, this growing process in this. Then last week we moved to the second one on here. First of all, it says, trust in the Lord. Secondly, in verse 4, it says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. As we trust the Lord, moving deeper into that relationship is where he takes us with this one, the idea of delighting in him. And we called attention to the Westminster Confession, which says, answers the question, what is the chief end of man? In other words, what is my reason for existence? The reason I'm here, everything in life to be built on, and gives the answer to that as being that our main reason for existence is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. And enjoy Him. So it's not just a matter of trusting Him, but enjoying Him. And that word for delight that was there, we talked about it, it's the idea of luxuriating in God and savoring the wonder of who He is, of taking pleasure in Him. And noted that it's even used today in Israel as a term there for party. When I think of that, I think of as we started the service here and seeing our worship team, not the ones up here, the ones down here. So if you're sitting too far back, you actually miss a piece of our music and celebrating in song, because it's happening right here. And to see these kids dancing their hearts out, delighting and spinning and doing all those moves and stuff like that. I'm thinking, the Lord must love that. Love that. Delighting in the Lord. And delight frees us to experience contentment. It frees us from simply envying those other things that we think that somehow will fill the emptiness inside us. Delighting in Him frees us from all that. Now, having put those two things out in front of us, the idea of trusting in the Lord, which addresses the evildoers, really, and delighting in the Lord, which addresses the wrongdoers, you know, the companion pieces of that, those two set us up for the next thing that He brings out, which is, it's found in verse 5 and actually goes 5 and 6. It says, commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in Him, and He will do it. Now, does that sound like your translation? Yours might be a little different, but it should sound something like that. Okay? Let's take this one apart. Let's look, first of all, at that word, way. It says, commit your way to Him. And that term that's used here is a word that runs throughout the Old Testament, and it has to do with your life journey. It has to do with how you approach life and all that comes with it, all the pieces of it. It has to do with this, in fact, sometimes used of the condition of your life at that time. But it has all of life captured to this, your way. So as you came today, you brought your way here. That all the pieces of your life has it, how it's unfolding for you, the good, the bad, all that kind of stuff here. It's all of that, he says. And in light of the question that, or the issue that he's already raised about the evildoers and the wrongdoers here, he says, commit your way to the Lord. So look next at that word commit. Because on first blush on this, it may sound like, another commitment to make. Yeah, I'm going to trust in the Lord and delight in Him. And now you get kind of to this bottom line, saying, okay, make a new commitment. Commit yourself to Him. Now, there are other places in Scripture to talk about that, but not here. That is not the idea here. He's not now saying, okay, look, here's the deal. If you want life to work for you, you need to make a new commitment. You're going to be solid for God. Instead, the word that is used here is a word that means to unload something. Literally means to roll something on, to roll onto something. It's the idea, David's saying, look, bring your life with all the stuff that's part of it. The good, the bad, the sideways. The good pieces that you enjoy, the brokenness, all that. He says, bring all that in here, your frustration with life, all of that, and roll it on to Him. Now, doesn't that feel good already? I mean, it's this idea of, you can imagine yourself picturing this thing, because it's a very visual word that's used here, of bringing the weight of life in, you know, just rolling yourself in here with it. Some of you did. I mean, some of you probably feel the weight of life on you. All the things that literally weigh you down and kind of cause you to walk a little bit stooped over because of the weight of it. And David says, take that and offload it onto the Lord. Wouldn't that feel good? Just if you could just take all that and just kind of drop it onto Him. It says, commit your way to the Lord, roll it onto Him, unload it onto Him, put the weight of all of that onto Him. It's a wonderful thing. And then he follows it up right away. He says, unload it onto Him, unload your way onto Him, commit your way to Him. And then, I don't know how your translation puts it, my translation says, trust also in Him. Does that sound like what yours is? Yeah. But let me share something with you. Okay, this is your benefit of being here. As I was studying this, as I was going through this, and I've been working with this psalm for some time now this year, I noticed something here. That, you know, back in verse 3, it says, trust in the Lord. But when I got to this one, it's different. It doesn't say, trust also in him. Literally, it says, trust on him. Which this made me think, huh, now why is that different? And if your mind works like mine, I can't resolve, you know, I can't rest until I figure out why. I mean, why is it different? And as I pursued it, I found that it carries the idea of not just trusting someone, trusting in them. That's, you're trusting the character of someone. But this is a more active form of it, where it's the idea of entrusting someone. Trust, then entrust. You're saying, roll your life onto him, all the pieces up, move it over there, and entrust him with it. Now, think about that for a moment. A little bit of a picture here. I don't have visuals, as I did a year ago, or 2 years ago, of my granddaughter. She just turned 2. She's very 2. Still as cute as ever. And she's learned that she's going to be having a sister. So a year from now, I will have pictures. But my son and daughter-in-law love their daughter. I mean, they love their daughter. Life swirls around their daughter. When Elliot is in the room, that's the only thing happening. You know, my son is way into the Giants. You have a Giant game on, but it's background noise if she's there. Because she's the center of everything. They love their daughter. And every once in a while, Ruthie and I get the chance to babysit her. They go off and do something. Now, for them to do that, there needs to be 2 things happening. They need to trust us, for one thing. They need to be confident in who we are and our ability to handle the situation and their love for their daughter. And they need to trust. They had to have trust in us. But when it comes time to leave, they are entrusting Elliot to us. Okay, now it's the point of action now. It's one thing to trust us. It's something else to entrust us with the most valuable possession they have, their daughter. Now there's the picture of it. What David is saying is bring your life, all the good and the bad, the brokenness, everything, take all of that and load it on to the Lord and entrust him with it. Which means that you're not going to just do that as a perfunctory thing where you come in and say, okay, here I am, Lord, again. Here's my stuff. And then you walk off dragging it with you again. But it's this idea of I'm going to unload it and I'm going to entrust him with it. That I'm going to trust not only the person of God, but his ability to do it. Notice what he says. Entrust him with it, and he will do it. Now, how you say that next line is important. Because you could say it, entrust him with it, and he will do it. Different emphasis. But the way it's written here, it's the idea of entrust him with it, and he will do it. In other words, he will be the activating force in your life. He will be the one that guides everything that you do. He will be the one that brings the pieces together and determines the ultimate outcome of this very thing. And trust him with it. That idea of him being the one who does things, who takes it and runs with it, is something that chases us all the way through the Old Testament, into the New Testament, all the way down to Paul's letters to us. For example, in Galatians 2:20, Paul writes, it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life I live now in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. The idea that He is now the one who is actually the life within me, the one who is determining how my life moves. Now, it's a great idea. We look at that and we go, okay, yes, that's exactly what I want. I want to unload my life onto Him. I want Him to be the one that's running it. I want my life to be seen in Christ and not in me and all these kinds of things. But it still comes down to how do you do that? We get some insight, considerable insight, from Proverbs, where you're going. Okay? Probably one of the pieces, so we won't talk a lot about it, but it's probably one of the places you're going to land somewhere along the way. Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6, where it says, trust in the Lord. Okay, there's our thing. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. In other words, this is not a half-hearted deal. This is I'm choosing to do this with my full being. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, your own perception of how life works, your own way of figuring things out. It says, in all your ways, acknowledge Him. Now, there's kind of some practical insight that there's this idea that I'm going to take all the pieces of my life and individually identify them and say, I'm going to put this piece there and this piece there and this piece there. Because one thing to say, I'm going to unload my whole life on Him. But something else to kind of get down to all the granular pieces of it and realize that each one of those I need to continually place before Him. I need to continually drop that back onto Him rather than me trying to run it. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths. With this whole idea here, as it's unfolding, and more of what we'll do next time. One of the things about this psalm, I've mentioned some things already about it. I mentioned it's the at the end of David's life. Last week, I added the layering of it being an acrostic psalm. Remember that? Okay, so it's beautifully written, and each line begins with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. But there's another thing about this psalm, and that is that it has been referred to by biblical scholars, those who are far smarter than I'll ever be, as being David's take on the Beatitudes. That's an interesting thing. It's like the Beatitudes of the Old Testament. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the Beatitudes, that would not be uncommon. Okay, most people read through the Beatitudes and they go, what? You know, and they're trying to get on to something else because the first of those Beatitudes, they sound like strange things. Like they're eight random parables that Jesus pulled out of air and said, hey, pretty cool, huh? And they were going, what? What is this all about? Or maybe eight descriptions of individuals, none of which we want to be. So you read those and go, yeah, fine, we move on to something else. But this is another place where I've spent some study over the last year. And what I came away with, you know, this is good, this will be a different thing, okay, we'll do this on another day, but just to call attention to this, because this psalm is considered the Old Testament version of the Beatitudes, as you read through the Beatitudes, okay, you can do this on your own, but there are eight. And there's a reason why Jesus leads with this when he goes into the Sermon on the Mount. Because they describe how someone, they describe a citizen of the kingdom. The first eight describe how someone enters the kingdom, or is how someone is saved. The second four describe how someone functions within the kingdom. Now, if you see it that way, they suddenly start to make sense. And you walk through those. I'm going to do this very briefly. I realize this is a little side thing, but it makes sense when we come back. Those Beatitudes, the first four are essentially blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek. And you can see already why we're going, what? Who wants that? And then blessed are those who a hunger and thirst after righteousness. The other words on those, what is being said here is that blessed are those, first of all, as far as those who are poor in spirit, those who realize they cannot manage life. Those who have realized that life cannot be controlled, that I somehow can't, as much as I try, I cannot manage life in such a way as to make it work the way I desire to. Those who have given up on that idea realize, I cannot do this, that I've got a problem here. Second one is blessed are those who mourn. In other words, not only do I have a problem, but I have to recognize that the problem has a name in the scriptures, and the name is sin. And that it's not somebody else's sin, it's mine. And therefore I grieve over it. Realize I have a problem, realize the problem is me. And next one, blessed are the meek. In other words, those who realize that I can't solve it on my own, I have to look outside myself to somewhere else to find an answer to this. And then, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. I want to pause there again, because this is where I wanted to get us. Righteousness in the Old Testament, the terminology that moves itself all the way down to the New Testament, is the idea of being right with someone, of being approved, of having that thing that we all long for. We all long to be approved. In fact, we live most of our life waiting for the verdicts, of whether or not we're approved. I mentioned my student, okay, living her life seeking approval, whether it was God's approval or her grandmother's approval, but somehow waiting for the verdict. Am I good enough? Am I enough in general? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after not only righteousness, approval, but it literally says who hunger and thirst after the righteousness, something beyond anything I can manufacture. The approval, the ultimate approval, God's approval in things. Now notice what the psalmist says here, what David says. He says, commit your way to the Lord, unload it onto him, and he will do it. And then in verse 6, and he will bring forth your righteousness. He'll bring forth your righteousness as the light, and your judgment as the noonday. Those that, during David's time, who were placing this whole thing in light of saying, if God approves of me, then this is how it's going to play out. And David said, no, wait. The picture's not over. You're only seeing a piece of this here. But rather, there's something bigger going on here. And as you take your life and unload it onto him and allow him be the one that is driving your life, that God is going to be the one who brings to light the fact that you are the one that he approves. The others are going to pass away. Their things are going to be gone. But he will bring to light your approval, his judgment of you, that you are mine. I would have to somehow use it as an illustration, but tomorrow morning is going to be the eclipse. Right? Yes. I heard several of you go, oh, that's right, the eclipse, okay, big event. It's going to last, what, a whole 2 minutes or something like that. But I thought of that in light of this, that it's so easy to live a life of an eclipse where our own life blocks out the sun, the light of our God. And by removing ourselves, moving off to the side, we allow for that to come to light, for God to bring to light our rightness, our approval. Now, I'll bring back one more time my student. Here's what made all the difference for her. Because as we talked it out, at one point I asked her, so when God looks at you, what does he see? When the Father looks at you, what does he see? And she kind of played around with the answer a bit. He sees someone who's trying hard. He sees someone who is attempting to love him honestly. He sees someone who's broken, who falls. I mean, she went on and on, but all the same things you and I would say. I said, oh. Realize that you are now in the Son, right? Your life has been placed in him. Like Paul wrote, Galatians 2:20, that I am now, my life is in him. And when the Father looks at me, who does he see? He sees his Son. He sees his Son. And is the Father ever disappointed in the Son? Never. And I could see her face kind of like, that's it. This idea that instead of pursuing something that will somehow show that I am valid, that I am as good as a guy, that somehow I'm successful in life and all the other pieces that go with it, to find that my life is in Jesus. And that because of that, the Father looks at me and is delighted in me. Not because I've somehow risen to another level, but because I have rolled my life unto him and entrusted him with it. And that's where the delight comes. Let's pray.